3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nations, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
Five, four, three, two, one.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio.
Welcome to Activism, Struggle and Labour History, a summer series featuring talks from the 2019 Australian Society for the Study of Labour History Conference. My name's Ian McIntyre. The first talk we'll hear today is from Charlie Fox, who taught Australian history at both the University of Melbourne and the University of Western Australia before retiring in 2011. His paper concerns the killing of four Chinese seamen on the Fremantle waterfront in 1942, two by Australian troops stationed on the wharf and two by Dutch troops from a nearby minesweeper. The paper discusses the long history of militancy and internationalism among seafarers, the competing accounts of the immediate causes of the deaths, the short-term consequences for relationships between Australia and China, and the implications of the killings for changes to Australian laws affecting Chinese seafarers.
This paper's about the killing of four Chinese seamen in Fremantle in early 1942, shortly after Japan entered the Second World War. In part, it's a transnational story. In part, it recovers aspects of Chinese history in Australia. One of the killings is well enough known among historians, the other is not. As far as I can see, no one's written about what actually happened. And as this seems to have been the only time when Chinese or any foreign seamen were killed in the course of an industrial dispute here in Australia, it seems worthwhile taking a closer look. So I'm really interested in drilling down, I guess, into the killings in a little more detail, well, a lot more detail. And many thousands of Chinese seamen sailed into and out of Fremantle over the years. They were largely hired from southern China, Hong Kong, Southeast Asian ports. They crewed ships on the many shipping lines, which were the arteries which held national and imperial economies together. They worked as quartermasters, stokers, deck and kitchen hands, and many more, part of a workforce which across the globe must have numbered in the hundreds of thousands. Chinese seamen were employed by labour contractors who sent a portion of their earnings back to their families, a portion of their earnings to the ship owners to pay for living costs, and what little was left, the seamen themselves were given to spend as they could. Their pay and conditions was based on a standard called Asian Articles, a racially based standard called Asian Articles, always lower than Australian, British and American equivalents, and they all looked enviously at the higher pay of seamen based in the many ports they sailed into. And they were organised. Chinese seamen founded the Chinese Seamen's Union in 1921, early in the first Chinese Republic. Then in 1922, unhappy with declining wages, they staged a big and victorious strike in Hong Kong. So when they struck in Fremantle for higher pay in 1924 and 1925, the union was already a force to be reckoned with in China and Hong Kong, and it developed strong connections with other seamen's unions along the way. They had a firm friend in the communist-led Seamen's Union of Australia, which supported their industrial actions wherever they happened to be taking part in. They helped with negotiations with captains of ships, agents of the shipping companies, garnering support amongst other trade unions and trades and labour councils, inviting them to demonstrations, accommodating them in trades halls, and restricting ship's captains from hiring seamen from other countries, including Australia. I like the statement by Frank Broza, University UWA academic who died many years ago, that militancy and political radicalism were inherently anchored in maritime work. But it's also true that internationalism was as well, and many historians have mentioned this point, that it seems to be in their bones. Japan entered the Second World War on the 7th of December 1941, but had invaded China something like 7 years earlier, or 6 years earlier. In fact, it's 5 years earlier. And by the time the killings had happened, had conquered most of Southeast Asia and displaced the European empires there. Now the Chinese were Australia were Chinese allies in the fight against Japan. In Australia, new wartime security legislation had been passed dealing with the treatment of, quote, aliens, which included amendments and regulations, dealing with issues such as the presence of Chinese, of foreign seamen in Australian ports, including their industrial actions. In addition, a strict veil of censorship had been laid over the Australian media, blanketing news which could be considered useful to the enemy or which might upset the Australian people. As all civilian shipping in the war had been declared military targets, German raiders had already sunk many Australian ships, including, of course, the Sydney off the West Australian coast in 1941. But the situation became much worse when Japan entered the war. Ships from fleets in the region began to seek refuge in Australian ports, including Fremantle, and as the war progressed, shipping became a constant worry to Australian governments. It was crucial for the supply of armaments, troops and other wartime supplies to battlefronts. And maintaining a regular supply of ships was a key preoccupation of governments. Indeed, the Australian government had begun to commandeer all those ships which had sought refuge in Australian ports. So late in 1941, six ships of the British-owned China Navigation Company, which were all crewed by Chinese seamen, docked in Fremantle. The relations between the seamen and their captains had deteriorated over their journey to Frio. They had demanded higher pay, better conditions and better wartime danger money. Things were worst on the ship called the Chongqing, which was also the name of the Chinese capital in China during the war, where the crew was alleged to have seized the British captain and threatened him with violence if pay rises weren't forthcoming. The captain alleged that the real cause of the trouble was not an industrial dispute, but that the crew was, as he said, quote, scared to go to sea. Local officers of the security details on the wharf, on the other hand, thought that these Chinese seamen were being led by subversives, quote unquote. In Fremantle, a conference of the captain, representatives of the seamen, the shipping company's agent, the army and the navy, the WA branch of the SUA, a meeting was held and hammered out the agreement, which asked the seamen to go back to work and when things would be sorted out later. The seamen agreed but changed their mind overnight and continued their strike. So there are two versions about what happened next. The first is drawn from accounts of military authorities, police inquiry, a coroner's inquest, and written reports given to the Chinese legation in Canberra, who came across to Perth to investigate the events. So on the 28th of January 1942, while seamen from the six ships who were on the docks and on a couple of the ships were rounded up and driven off in trucks, soldiers with rifles, bayonets and Tommy guns, submachine guns, arrived on the wharf to remove the remaining crews from the other ships. When the soldiers boarded the Chongqing, the crew massed together and rushed them. As I said, this is the Australian military perspective. The first casualty, Tong Yuan Tong, a tall, quote, Chinaman who was described as the ship's quartermaster and the leader of the strike. A married man from Ningpao near Shanghai. He was described as having the appearance of a fanatic, which is a common racial slur in these matters. He's also reported to be shouting in English, "What for, what for, what for?" And then he reportedly ran himself onto a bayonet and was ultimately shot dead within about 2 or 3 seconds. The other crewmen had tried to flee, running onto another ship moored alongside the ships being moored three abreast, in an attempt to get to the wharf, and two other seamen were injured. The second casualty, Su Ping Sei, had run away from the soldiers and refused to stop when called on, was shot in the legs and was found dead a little later on. The second version compiled by the Chinese legation, after discussions with their seamen, told a very different story. The crew did ask the captain for higher wages, but made no threats. After the captain called the authorities, what they called several scores of soldiers arrived with two ambulances, rounded up Chinese seamen on the wharf, and without warning invaded the Chongqing. Believing they were about to be forced back to work, the seamen tried to force their way off the ship. At this point, the first seaman was killed, and the second was shot later as he ran away from another soldier. The legation then claimed that the arrival of the soldiers was unnecessary, that they should have explained why they were there, that the shooting of the seamen was unwarrantable and deliberate, and subsequently the Chinese legation entered a protest against the events to the Australian government. There are several points that can be made from the inquiries. First, all the soldiers involved didn't intend to kill anybody. The soldier who bayoneted Tong claimed that Tong had indeed run himself onto the bayonet, which went into his groin, but he did not make a deliberate lunge at him. Of the shooting, one witness said Tong was shot as he continued to rush the soldiers, but another witness, who was the commander of naval intelligence at the time, said that the commander of the troops, Lieutenant McGuckin, shot Tong and that, quote, Tong was first of all bayoneted in an attempt to stop him, but he had to be shot to stop a riot. McGuckin insisted, on the other hand, that he never intended to kill Tong, telling the coroner, if I had, I would have shot him in the head. It also emerged that the post-mortem on Hsu Ping Sei had been shot in the back, not in the legs. None of the soldiers seemed keen to say that they meant to kill their victims. They made it seem as though it was all a case of misadventure. The coroner found that no blame could be attached to the soldiers who were doing their duty, but in earlier correspondence he actually wondered why the whole event wasn't dealt with differently, that it should be dealt with in the civil courts as they had been over generations in Fremantle. And he wrote, it appears to me on perusal of the reports admitted that the trouble on the SS Chungking might well have been left to the civil authorities. Therefore, I consider an inquest onto the deaths of the two Chinese seamen as essential. And he wrote a very cryptic finding to this to his inquiry. It was very regrettable that these men were killed, but the authorities must have had some excellent reason for taking these drastic steps, reasons about which it would be better not to know. So the statement obviously raises a lot more questions than answers. What did the coroner mean? What did he know? Was it misadventure? Was he saying the killings were deliberate? Were the killings designed to free up the ships to sail? Was the idea to give two Chinese seamen an exemplary punishment? The Chinese seamen in Sydney had set up a branch of the Chinese Seamen's Union just a few weeks before this happened. News of the actual killing was censored, and no record of it appeared anywhere, but strangely, the coronial inquiry was not censored. So the coroner's findings became the public story, and subsequently it was picked up by newspapers right across the country. Again, why the coroner's report wasn't censored when the actual wasn't censored when the actual events were is another interesting question. The upshot of the killings were that several troublemakers, quote-unquote, were sent to a detention centre in Fremantle, and the rest were sent to the quarantine station at Woodman's Point, which is somewhat south of Frio. Of those originally sent to Woodman Point, 81 volunteered to return to sea, but only if they were paid British pay rates, so they still were reluctant to go to sea. Those who stayed were drafted into the labour units of the AMF, and there's disagreement about who thought this was a good idea. The Seamen's Union are credited at one point with suggesting it. The Chinese seamen themselves, one source says, volunteered. The military said that they forced them to do it, and the Chinese diplomats said it was their idea as well. Either way, it seemed a good result out of this tragedy. The sailors were exempted from the Australian Immigration Act and paid Australian military wages. Most were eventually sent to Sydney to make barges for the Americans in Sydney and Brisbane, where they received extremely high rates of pay, and they were repatriated or deported to China after the war. Given that the families of the Chinese seamen were supposed to receive compensation in the events of their death or injury, the Chinese legation demanded compensation from the government for the men's families. The government refused, citing the findings of the coroner, arguing that the coroner's report absolved it of any obligation to give redress to families, which I think is rather strange, as did the Chinese legation, who replied with astonishment that the government would use such a lame excuse to avoid its obligations. And it's unclear whether the families received any compensation at all, ever. Amazingly, the episode was repeated again almost exactly 6 weeks later, this time on a Dutch tanker. And who knows, this was possibly inspired by the earlier killings. But this time the episode was blanketed in complete sense of silence. The ship, called the Sirona, arrived in Fremantle from Ceylon on the 29th of March 1942. The crew had been unsettled since coming from Calcutta, and although asking for an increase in pay, had sailed onto Frio. In Fremantle they made the same demand, and when the Dutch captain refused, they demanded to be paid off. The authorities replied that this was a civil, not a military matter, which was very interesting in relation to what had happened previously. And the captain accused the ringleader of stabbing another crewman, had him arrested. After the crew demanded he be released, relations on board turned ugly. The captain refused, ordered all the crew to leave the ship. They refused, so the captain called for assistance from a nearby Dutch corvette, telling the captain of that ship that his crew had mutinied and calling for armed sailors to come and eject them from the ship, which they did. The men refused to go, the Chinese seamen refused to go. The Dutch sailors, having been instructed by the commanding officer to use force, did use force. They attacked the crew, killing two men and wounding another four. Six Chinese men were taken to military custody, although they were released later, and the rest returned to the tanker. But they refused to sail in the tanker again, and in the meantime, the Dutch authorities claimed that the men were, quote, fifth columnists and mutineers. The matter was sent to the West Australian Crown Prosecution Service and the State Solicitor, who noted that a prima facie case for murder could be held against the Dutch officer concerned and the two sailors who killed the two seamen. They decided not to recommend a prosecution on the grounds that it was unlikely to succeed. The Australian government's response to this was to declare that it was the Dutch government's business, not their own. The case was mainly the concern of the Netherlands, in that the origins of the dispute and the physical consequences took place on Netherlands territory. That is to say, the ship was Netherlands territory. But was the Sirona sovereign Dutch territory? I mean, I tried to find out what it meant at the time, but it was so mind-bending that I couldn't make head or tail of it. So it was to London where the Chinese government went in search of justice. But the London government in exile from Holland told the Chinese legation that they accepted responsibility for the shootings, but that the victims were mutineers in wartime, they brought the deaths upon themselves, and therefore refused point blank to pay compensation. Why was the Dutch government so hard line? It seems clear that it was an extension of the Dutch government's interwar campaign against what they called subversives on their shipping lines and in their ships. They had in mind that a range of different people comprised these subversives, trade unionists, Chinese movements, extremist movements, foreign movements, and a good part of the work of captains was involved in surveilling these so-called subversives in the interest of the government. It's also clear that they thought the CSU was a communist union, and given that the Dutch fully intended to return to Indonesia after the war, these killings then, I think, were another part of their continuing struggle to maintain their Indonesian colony, this time in a foreign port in Fremantle. One of the consequences of the first killings was that the surviving Chinese seamen were given work on shore in the army in labour battalions. It's possible that this was the inspiration for Chinese and other Asian seamen in the East adopting demands for shore work as an alternative to going to sea and getting exemptions from the Immigration Restriction Act to allow them to do so. Heather Goodall, however, suggested this kind of arrangement might have begun in Sydney in 1941, and the flow of information might have gone from Sydney to Perth rather than Perth to Sydney. But she's certainly convincing when she talks about the communications between Chinese and other seamen, Chinese, Indian, Indonesians across the continent, where information about wages, conditions, danger money, compensation, exemption certificates were passed between them. In the eastern states, industrial action continued for at least another 2 years until the federal government did two important things. It introduced regulations to the National Security Act. Alien control, threatening alien seamen who engaged in any industrial action with arrest, imprisonment and deportation unless they accepted an offer to sail. But it also gave itself an out in the regulations by allowing such seamen to work in Australia in, quote, such places and on such terms as the minister determines. Also in late 1942, it set up an inquiry into the wages and conditions of Chinese seamen operating from Australian ports, which recommended adopting a system of wages and conditions which pretty much matched Australian conditions. So in effect, Chinese seamen, through all this industrial action, were given more or less the same wages and conditions as Australian seamen. In effect, this was the end of Asian Articles, with all its racial and discriminatory assumptions and clauses. Yet once the war was over, the pre-war situation status quo quickly returned. The shipping lines restored the Asian articles, and the Australian government closed the door on Asian seamen working on shore. And the gains they had made during the war, therefore, proved to be short-lived indeed.
You've been listening to Charlie Fox discussing industrial action and the murder of Chinese seafarers during World War II. Charlie's latest publication is Radical Perth Militant Fremantle, which was edited with Alexis Vasili, Bobby Oliver and Lenore Lehman.
You said you'd meet me in the corner of Russell and Victoria when I arrived, you weren't there. So I opened up the bottle of red I brought to share and sat upon the monument stairs.
It says here,
my battle's fought and won.
It says here,
a victory's long time coming. An 8-hour day, an honest working wage. It's just history, sitting on the steps of the 8-hour monument, drinking my day away. Sitting on the steps of the 8-hour monument, thinking what would the ghosts of a great grandparent say? Across the road, Trades Hall, and behind me, the old Melbourne jail. I bought a souvenir mug to drink out of with the death mask of Edward Kelly.
It says here,
Ned's parting word.
It says here,
such is life. Where in heavens are you? What the hell am I to do? And how on earth did it end up this way?
It's just history.
Sitting on the steps of the 8-hour monument, drinking my day away. Sitting on the steps of the 8-hour monument, thinking what would they say? Sitting on the steps of the 8-hour monument, drinking my day away. Sitting on the steps of the 8-hour monument, thinking what would the ghosts of a great grandparent say?
You're listening to Activism, Struggle and Labour History, a summer series featuring talks from the 2019 Australian Society for the Study of Labour History Conference. My name is Ian McIntyre, and the track that we just heard was from Melbourne band The Currency, 888. The next talk that we're going to be listening to is from Sibel Locke, who is a New Zealand history lecturer at Victoria University of Wellington. Her paper concerns the role of the Northern Drivers' Union in the anti-racist and anti-apartheid movements from the 1950s to the 1970s in New Zealand.
The rise of Māori and Pacifica protest, Pacific Island People's Protest, in 1970s New Zealand has been well canvassed by scholars such as Aroha Harris, Ranganui Walker, Malani Anaya. radical protest groups, Ngā Tamatoa, the Young Warriors, and the Polynesian Panthers emerged in inner city Auckland, simultaneously influenced by local conditions and transnational black power movements. These organisations were largely formed by young Māori and Pacifica peoples who'd grown up in Auckland City and experienced racism at school from neighbours, landlords and the courts, and from employers as competition for jobs increased from the late 1960s. Now, while their parents had worked really hard to create cultural spaces to be Māori or Polynesian in the city, in their homes and churches and community centres, young people began to challenge institutional racism and relentless pressure to assimilate. So they campaigned to save the Māori language from extinction. They drew attention to the broken promises of the Treaty of Waitangi. They led protests against the Labour, both Labour and National Government's racist dawn raids that targeted Pacifica peoples in their homes and on the streets, demanding that they show their passports to prove that they weren't overstayers, right, overstaying their temporary visas. They were the radical wing of the anti-apartheid movement, and they formed the logistical backbone of the Māori Land March in 1975, demanding not one more acre of Māori land be alienated. They joined Māori land occupations such as Bastion Point in Auckland in 1977. Now, feminist scholars have contextualised this history by drawing attention to the relationships between the women's movement and Māori feminism and linking it through into Māori sovereignty movements beginning in the 1980s. More recent scholarship, such as Angelique Stasny and Raymond Orr, placed Māori protest in the context of black power and transnational networks of Indigenous activism, so of course here too as well. Evan Puata-Smith, Toby Borumen have discussed relationships between class identity and radical Māori organisation. I've connected Māori radicals to trade unions. So today I want to put the spotlight on the Northern Drivers Union, which is an organisation of predominantly truck drivers, and explore what gave rise to the union's anti-racism work well before this period that I just talked about. So I guess it's kind of work that's similar to that done by Peter Cole and Peter Lim recently on waterside workers in Australia and San Francisco, and looking at their long commitment to anti-apartheid activism. So in 1956, 32-year-old publicly known communist Winstone's truck driver, Bill Anderson, was elected secretary of the Northern Drivers Union. Bill had been a merchant seaman during the Second World War and radicalised by conditions of the job. He returned from the war a committed communist with a hatred for racism. Now, Bill's anti-racism arose from witnessing the treatment of Arab dock workers in ports like Aden. And so in Auckland, when he returned, he was nurtured by strong friendships with other maritime trade union communist leaders who set an example of united front communism, building democratic, industrially militant cultures inside the Seamen's Union and then the Waterside Workers' Union on the road to socialism. However, militant trade unionism became increasingly difficult in New Zealand, as in many other places, as Cold War anti-communist rhetoric was unleashed by the Labour government and the Federation of Labour in 1948 and continued by the National Government from 1950. So trade union militants were demonised as a communist threat to the national and international economic and political interests. Bill was blacklisted first from seafaring, then from freezing work, and finally from the waterfront. Now, the waterfront lockout is incredibly well known, but just in case. Okay, so the trigger was a disagreement over a wage rise. Wharfies refused overtime until this dispute was settled with their employers. The employers took this as an opportunity to end the union. They declared it an illegal strike and locked out all watersiders from the wharves. The national government backed up the employers and brought in the waterfront strike emergency regulations into force. So the waterside workers' union's registration was cancelled, all the funds and records were seized, police powers were increased to arrest anyone aiding the watersiders, and this side of the story was banned from the newspapers. And troops were enlisted to unload the wharves. Support strikes spread, but were undermined when the Federation of Labour came out against the waterside workers. And after 5 months, it ended in defeat for the watersiders. The union was replaced by 26 port unions, and most were unable to return to wharf work. Now, Labour historians have cast the 1951 waterfront lockout as the last hurrah of militant New Zealand trade unionism right up until 1968. What I found is those locked out Waterside workers quietly ceded trade union democracy and tempered militancy through the 1950s and 1960s in a number of male-dominated blue-collar unions. And so it was with the support of 200 ex-Waterside workers, now truck drivers, and a very tiny handful of communists that got Bill Anderson elected, first as an organiser in 1954 and then the union secretary in 1956. And he set about democratising this union. So delegates were elected on every work site with 20 workers or more. And then from 1958, delegates all came together annually to discuss the issues of the day. And it was in these kinds of forums that the meaning of trade unionism became redefined, and anti-racism became trade union business. So the numbers of drivers' union delegates grew across the 1950s, and Māori drivers were active amongst them. As Māori moved in from their rural tribal homelands that could no longer sustain them with land alienation to the city in post-war New Zealand, they not only remade workforces, as they remade trade unions as well. So they clustered together on particular work sites where collective ways of being Māori informed the practices and the values of the workplace. So, for example, Māori men would go and join, become breweries drivers, where their family members were and their friends were. And older Māori men would then take on the role of delegate, foreman, and act as a tribal elder to those youngsters coming in as truck drivers and kind of playing that role. And so as the driver delegate system expanded, increasing numbers of Māori members were getting involved in Māori affairs. Now, Māori drivers made their pākehā, so white New Zealand, union officials aware of incidences that were happening of racial discrimination in the workforce, those employers who were refusing to hire truck drivers if they had brown skin. And so in response to this, Northern Drivers officials organised to gain reinstatement of Māori workers where this was occurring. And policy, anti-racism policy, was put in place in 1960. Bill Anderson argued, racial discrimination has the effect of dividing the working people, and we should be united irrespective of our colour, religion or political beliefs. Bill believed Māori and Pākehā should unite as working class to struggle for equality. And drivers agreed with him, right? They argued the colour bar does exist to some extent in New Zealand. It must be vigorously stamped out, root and branch. And this is really significant, right? Because mainstream New Zealand society in 1960 believed that New Zealand was a place of racial harmony. Northern drivers' policy opposing racial discrimination most likely came out of the 1959 No Māoris, No Tua campaign, which began in 1959. Some drivers joined the Citizens All Black Tour Association, which formed to protest the exclusion of Māori from the All Blacks team selected to tour South Africa in 1960. And then, of course, in May 1960, peaceful demonstrators in Sharpeville were shot dead by the police, and the press brought the reality of what was going on in South Africa home to the outside world. So Bill condemned these shootings and beatings and mass punishments of coloured South African workers and the suppression of the rights to organise. And it's in this context that the Federation of Labour, moving markedly from where they were in 1951, called on the government to cancel the 1960 tour. But the Labour Prime Minister, Walter Nash, refused to intervene, leaving that decision to the New Zealand Rugby Football Union, who, of course, went ahead with the tour. In 1962, though, the Northern Drivers' Union successfully promoted a remit at the Federation of Labour Conference that year that South African goods be boycotted to challenge apartheid, and it was passed. The Northern Drivers' Union also supported the work of Citizens Association for Racial Equality, which formed in 1964, predominantly Pākehā group, although there were Māori members as well. And so they had a dual purpose, to focus on what was going on in South Africa, but also to do something about the racism being experienced by Māori and Pacific Island migrants in Auckland City. So in the face of widespread opposition, the planned 1967 All Blacks tour of South Africa was cancelled. However, at this point in time, very cunningly, South African Prime Minister John Vorster adapted the rules so that Māori and Pacific Island players could be included in the All Blacks touring as honorary whites in 1970. And he said as long as there weren't too many and they weren't too black. So in response, CARE hosted Dennis Brutus, president of the South African Non-Racial Olympic Committee, to strengthen their campaign against sporting contacts with South Africa. So Brutus spoke at the Auckland Town Hall, and he argued that, you know, this tour would demonstrate New Zealand's approval of apartheid laws. So Northern Drive's executive member, Wally Foster, who's a Māori South Auckland council driver, found Brutus to be a really persuasive speaker, and he sought to educate other drivers' members on why they should oppose the tour. So he published in the Drivers' Union newspaper. He said, each year at the annual convention of the Northern Drivers' Union, when race relations are being discussed, the delegates have always adopted a policy which has condemned racial discrimination, racial prejudice, or racial disharmony. This is a very important part of our discussion of our annual conventions for the reasons that Pākehās, Māoris, Islanders, and others work side by side, engage at times in conflict with employers side by side, go home at night to live in our communities side by side. Racial harmony is a question of bread and butter for all working people here in New Zealand. Every worker, be he Pākehā, Māori or Islander, has problems of a similar nature. For example, housing, making the wage packet spin out, feeding the family, sending kids to school. These problems cannot be solved by allowing arguments over race or religion to divide us. So Foster presented union anti-racism policy, in this case opposing contacts with apartheid South Africa, as solidarity work to promote racial harmony of the working class in New Zealand. And some members, as these discussions took place at the annual delegates' convention, there did begin to be quite vocal support for the 1970 tour amongst drivers. Some members argued, we shouldn't drag politics into sport. The All Blacks could set South Africans a good example with a mixed race team. Māori play separately to Pākehā sometimes internationally. Isn't this kind of discrimination as well? Mm-hmm. Others responded, why should we care? Now, this, I would argue, was not a sign of apathy, but that rugby union was not that important. The majority of drivers were rugby league supporters. No league teams had sporting contacts with South Africa. So, what the? So while the Northern Drivers Executive were opposed to the 1970 tour, they did not gain the support of all of their members enough to pass that policy this time. The 1970 tour went ahead with one Samoan and two Māori players selected as honorary whites in the All Blacks team. The Northern Drivers Executive decided more union education was required, so they sponsored the visit of John Gutsawe, representative of the South African Congress of Trade Unions in May 1972. And he spoke at Northern Drivers Union stop work meetings about how the apartheid system was impacting South Africans designated black or coloured, with a particular focus on workers, and then moved on to meet with the Australian Maritime Unions over here. But feelings ran high at the ongoing meetings to respond to these issues, especially amongst ardent supporters of rugby union as a game. Some members argued the union shouldn't oppose apartheid in South Africa before cleaning up our own backyard. And again, members were divided over the issue, but this time the Labour-led government by Norman Kirk cancelled the 1973 tour. But taking direction from their members, the executive decided this time, okay, yes, let's educate our members on local racism. So they invited Ngā Tamatoa leaders, right, who had just emerged in Auckland, Hannah Jackson, to come and address Auckland Stop Work meetings and explain the work that they were doing in late 1973. And again, there were lovely, big, lively debates in response to the things she talked about, and then they gave her $100 to go away and say, great, keep doing that work. But continue to publish articles in the union newspaper about what Ngā Tamatoa were doing, what are the key issues for them, and then to kind of garner support for the Māori Land March in 1975. In 1976, the new national government, led by Robert Muldoon, announced that 24 hectares at Bastion Point on the Auckland waterfront would be subdivided, sold off, and redeveloped as a pricey retirement village. Ngāti Whātua Rākei were outraged. Now, Ngāti Whātua, so local tangi whenua, local people of that land, their chief, Apiha Te Kawo, back in 1840, had facilitated Pākehā settlement of Auckland by giving 300,000 acres to Governor Hobson as a gift, with the proviso that the 700-acre Rākei block on the waterfront was Ngāti Whātua's forever and ever. Of course, over time, they've been completely ignored, went away, purchased bit by bit in some really dubious land practices, till by 1950, all that was left was a small village where Ngāti Whātua lived on the waterfront. Things came to a head in 1951 when, on the pretext of protecting their health, the Crown evicted the remaining families, relocated them to nearby streets and new state houses. They're called Boot Hill, nicknamed Boot Hill. And Ngāti Whātua homes and their meeting house were burned to the ground. Eruini, or Eddie Hawke, was a Ngāti Whātua wolfie who'd stood loyal to the Waterside Workers Union in 1951. So that year, he lost his job, he lost his union, and he lost his marae. It was his son, Joe Hawke, who became the spokesperson for the Irake Māori Committee Action Group, who led an occupation of Bastion Point in early January 1977 that would last for 17 months. Eddie and his wife, Pupu Hawke, provided the internal leadership and inspiration for those who joined the occupation. Now, the Hawkes knew Bill Anderson, who by that stage was president of the Auckland Trades Council. Now, Eddie Hawke and Bill Anderson, of course, were comrades, right, from the 1951 waterfront lockout. But both Joe and his brother, his younger brother, Grant, knew Bill and respected him because he'd helped them form a Ngāti Whātua Orake League team at Sydney Newton Rugby League Club in 1975. So, actually, this is a league story as well as a club story. Okay. So, before the occupation began, a delegation from the Orake Māori Action Committee came to the Auckland Trades Council and won a motion of support to put a green ban on Bastion Point. So the council committed to policy that no subdivision work or redevelopment work would be carried out by workers. So when I interviewed truck driver Sid Kepper, he remembered Māori wanted to build rich people's houses on there. So that was a big draw card, not only for me, but some who are a bit iffy on Māori rights anyway. I was going up there to support the people at Takaparawha to keep the rich white people out. I don't think there was anything in it about supporting Māori rights. I think that's how the Auckland Trades Council sold it to the membership. It was about poor people against rich people, which I thought was a brilliant way of doing things, rather than say it was Māori land and it's there. So the whole Auckland Trades Council agreed to put the green ban on. So that was how it was opened up as an issue. And it was, sold very deeply, very much as a class issue. But as the occupation went on over months, there was a whole lot of education work and conversations that were again going on inside trade unions that focused on Māori land rights and learned about the history of colonisation that had happened at the point. Bill explained to members, all the jokes about the Pākehās stealing Māori land are almost correct. The Pākehās who have stolen Māori land were not drivers, storemen, labourers or carpenters. It was the stock and station companies and other carpetbaggers. That is the rich Pākehās or their agents. Many of our union members and other union members are amongst those who have been or are being robbed. The Great Māori Land March and the Bastion Point struggle represent the first real rollback in this long and infamous period of injustice against the Māori peoples. So you can see the shifting attitudes that were going on to the Māori land rights movement reflected in the Northern Drivers' Union's policy, right? So in 1977, there was one policy, and everyone agreed to opposition to all forms of racial discrimination at home and abroad, right? Nice kind of capture-all. But by 1978, the policy had expanded to four. So the first was equality of all races and harmonious relations between all workers for mutual progress. Two, greater involvement of Polynesian members in various positions in the union. Three, full support for justice for the Māori people for land rights. And four, opposition to all forms of apartheid in any area. On the 25th of May, 1978, 700 police and army personnel invaded Bastion Point. The military cordoned the land by a human ring of police officers who just kind of moved in. And they arrested 222 people, charging them with willful trespass. Bill Anderson was amongst them, and there he is there. But the green ban stayed in place, my friends. And after the occupation, Māori workers played increasingly prominent roles in their Auckland trade unions. In the Northern Drivers' Union, they dominated the executive, increasingly elected as organisers. John Willis became the president. And between 1978 and 1980, a range of really successful strike actions were waged, spearheaded by drivers, carpenters, labourers and pulp and paper workers. So working class solidarity held strong for these ethnically diverse male-dominated workforces and their unions. And an injury to one was just extended to include the injuries caused by the injustices of Māori land alienation. So to conclude, why were the Northern Drivers an anti-racist organisation from 1960? It had much to do with democratising the union. So the forums for debate and education, job meetings, delegate conventions, stop work meetings, union newspapers, but also the personal relationship and deep connections that are built. So the past solidarities that came through from the waterside workers. But then the new solidarity efforts that were formed along the way with new groups as they formed across the Auckland Isthmus. So thank you.
You've just heard a talk given by Sibel Locke at the Australian Society for Labour History's 2019 conference. Sibel is the author of Workers in the Margins, Union Radicals in Post-War New Zealand, which explores how working-class unionists, including the organised unemployed, negotiated neoliberalism, deindustrialisation and welfare retrenchment. Her current project is a biography of communist trade union leader Bill Anderson. Thanks for listening to Activism, Struggle and Labour History. We'll be back next week with more talks from the conference. If you'd like to find out more about the Australian Society for the Study of Labour History, its various branches and labour history in general, then please visit labourhistory.org.au.
I remember the day I was no more than a boy, working in an oxide plant at the back of North Fitzroy. Bert Gilchrist told a gaffer, 'cause Bert Gilchrist had the clout. He said they'd given got the bullet and the lads are walking out. And we walked right off that job while the gaffer held the door and watched it on the telly in a TV rental store. It was one hell of a situation, the kind you just can't gauge. There was Gough on the steps of Parliament House saying no, maintain the rage. In the year of the double dissolution, drinking in the streets gave way to doubt. Australia voted in a revolution, stood back and let the fat cats push it out. There was violence in the air as I walked back home that night. Everyone you'd meet was getting ready for the fight, saying if they're out for trouble, then trouble's what they'll get. We started out a colony, do they think we're a colony? Drinking in the streets gave way to doubt. Australia voted in a revolution, then stood back and let the fat cats push it out. But as the weeks went by, the anger turned to mild relief. Locks were freaked like magic, and I watched in disbelief to see a scam so blatant, so jacked up and full of holes. And the people in their thousands endorsed it at the polls. In the year of the double dissolution, drinking in the streets gave way to doubt. Australia voted in a revolution, then stood back and let the push it out. Some said they had it coming, some were closer to the mark. Who spoke about conspiracy, sinister and dark? But history records it, and the story will be read, how we let them take democracy and stand it on its head. In the year of the double dissolution, drinking in the streets gave way to doubt. Australia voted in a revolution, then stood back and let the fat cats push it out. Australia voted in the revolution, then stood back and let the fat cats push it out.
Seat. They broke down on the hillside, the radiator spitting steam. Went back to get the toolbox so they could fix the old machine. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, we can fix the tractor. We can make it like new. But that day they got a letter. They said the power lines would come right across their farmland, right across the setting sun. So they gathered all the family and talked late into the night. We cannot let them do this. We've got to put up one hell of a fight with a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw. We'll apply a little pressure and we'll see what that will do. So they phoned 100 farmers and drove to the Twin Cities. Met there with the governor and they sued the utility. But after writing all the letters and paying all the legal costs to the power of the city, once again the farmers lost. And in the still of the evening, the wind is all you hear. I watch the waves on the wheat fields alone. I walk the furrows of earth I plant year after year. This is our land, this is our home. This is our land, this is our home. So they met there at the tavern, but there wasn't much to say. The power lines may come, but they will not stay. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, once put together, we can easily undo. With bandanas on their faces, careful not to make a sound, they loosened all the bolts that held the towers to the ground. And several weeks later, with nobody around, Minnesota wind blew tower after tower after tower down. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, what was once put together, we can easily undo. With a turn of the wrench and a twist of the screw, what was once together, we can easily undo. And in the still of the evening, the wind is all you hear. I watch the waves on the wheat fields alone. I walk the furrows of earth I plant year after year. This is our land, this is our home. This is our land, this is our home. This is our land, this is our home. This is our land.